Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
If we're over Black Friday by the time Black Friday arrives, what does that mean for the economy? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, filling in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, November 27th. We are delighted you could be with us today. And since it is Friday, it's time for the weekly wrap. I am joined by Catherine Rampell of The Washington Post and Felix Salmon of Fusion. Hello there.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for suffering through a Black Friday visit to a closed office building to be on the show today.
No problem.
Now, I believe you've heard a little something about this Black Friday situation, which is either great or terrible, depending on who you talk to. So, Catherine, if it's terrible, what does that mean for retailers and the economy?
So I guess it depends on how you define terrible. Terrible to me would be getting trampled to death by huge crowds, I guess, which was the case in the past.
I meant more like if people don't buy things.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the other way to look at it. If people are not going to the stores today, and the early reports are that the crowds are a little bit thinner, is that such a big deal? My guess is no. I think a lot of the commerce that used to happen on Black Friday is probably shifting online. Based on both anecdotal evidence and actual data. And if people aren't going to the stores today, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're not going to pay as much for their holiday gifts this year as they have. In fact, Gallup had released a poll not that long ago suggesting that Americans were expecting to spend a lot more this Christmas season than last year. So I think probably not such a strong indicator either way.
Felix, do you think that if shopping shifts to a more year-round or online model, that retailers will have a harder time sort of planning for the year without these benchmark shopping days?
No, I think it'll be easier. I think what we're missing here is that Black Friday was never that big of a shopping day. It was always, first and foremost, a publicity stunt day, that it's a very slow news day, as we can tell by the state of the marketplace office in New York, and this is the only story that ever happens and that people can plan for. So there's always stories about this. But really, it's just a way for Walmart and Target and big box stores to get a bunch of free publicity. And if that's coming to an end, I don't think anyone's going to shed any tears. And it certainly doesn't really reflect on the economics of retailers.
I know I will not shed tears if it stops the stampeding situation. Let's move on quickly to inversions, these sort of mergers that have been happening, that there are attempts to stop them. And yet the Pfizer-Allergan deal, Catherine, would you say is basically a textbook example of an inversion?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you may recall that last year Pfizer had attempted a similar inversion with AstraZeneca, that they were going to have a merger to effectively lower Pfizer's tax rate. And that was aborted, I think, at least in part because there were concerns that the U.S. government, Congress, was going to step in and keep that from happening. And a year later, basically no action by Congress. There's been some action by Treasury to try to curb these types of inversions, but in this Pfizer-Allergan merger would not be touched, as far as I understand. So, it looks like it's going to go through and it's going to be exactly what everyone was worried was going to happen. Textbook case.
And right. And then I guess the question, Felix, becomes how serious, how much effect do these inversions actually have on our economy?
They reduce corporate tax revenue. Corporate tax revenue is not a huge part of the economy, but it's an important part of the fiscal mix. And if they continue to happen, then I think what's going to happen is, personally, my opinion is that rather than trying to prevent inversions, which I think is really hard on it for a bunch of different reasons, that if you want to keep the corporate tax revenue higher, you might just need to start taxing corporate revenues in the United States rather than trying to force corporations to pay tax on global revenues, which is just a really hard thing to do in this era of national taxation. So this is all, as you say, it's about tax dodges. There will always be tax dodges, but it's always going to be ultimately marginal.
Absolutely. Great. All right. Catherine Rampell of The Washington Post, Felix Salmon of Fusion. Thanks, you too.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, a short trading day with mixed results. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Now, this little interlude that just started this month or so between Thanksgiving and New Year's is huge for charities. It's when many nonprofits get the most traffic to their websites. But as you're making your end-of-year donations, you might be surprised to learn that your favorite charities sometimes share your personal information. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has more.
If you're the kind of person who only gives 10 bucks at a time to a charity, you're not exactly committed to it. So says Sandra Minuti with the watchdog group Charity Navigator.
It's going to cost them a lot of money to kind of move you through the funnel to be a more high-end committed donor. So a quick way for them to generate some additional revenue off of you is to sell your personal information.
Your name and contact info could go to other charities or to data brokers who put it together with other information about you so for-profit marketers can use it.
Most of the time you'll end up with a mailbox full of appeals from other charities, but you may also notice other types of catalogs and marketing materials showing up.
Some charities give donors the chance to sign off on this information sharing, but law professor Norman Silber at Hofstra University says polling data show most donors would not give consent.
The data is that they say no, it's not okay.
Direct Relief is a charity that provides emergency medical resources. It doesn't exchange or sell its donors' information. Chief Executive Thomas Teig says that's partly to avoid what he sees as a double standard. He says most charities would never share information about their high-end donors. They want to keep that to themselves.
We don't think it would be right to treat a person able to make a smaller contribution differently.
But security analyst Aviva Leighton at Gartner says if it is just piddly donors' information getting circulated, that might mean a lower risk of, say, cyber thieves getting a hold of it.
The bad guys that are going after the money don't want to waste their time on poor individuals.
She says cyber thieves want the names of the wealthy donors. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report 86 million American adults have prediabetes, and as many as a third of prediabetics are likely to become diabetic within 5 years. Beginning January 1st, virtually all private insurers must cover services with no copay that help people with prediabetes change their diets and increase their physical activity. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports that with that kind of market, companies are salivating over the opportunities.
It takes some guts to get into the diabetes business.
There are perhaps easier ways to build businesses if you're a talented entrepreneur than healthcare. But healthcare is a way where you can do it and just show up to work and feel really good about it.
Sean Duffy is co-founder of Omada Health, a company that's designed an online program for pre-diabetics to eat better, lose weight, and become more active. Omada is one of about 700 groups that are CDC certified, which offer intensive behavioral counseling. That includes the dude working out of a church as a health coach, to Weight Watchers, to the YMCA. Omada's chief commercial officer, Mike Payne, estimates this is as much as a $150 million industry now, which could more than triple by 2017.
Organizations like Omada and even the YMCA are getting to a scale that you need to deliver programs like this to tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people.
The CDC's Anne Albright hopes making these services essentially free cuts down on the number of diabetics. According to the American Diabetes Association, one of every five healthcare dollars is spent treating the condition.
We are on this ridiculous trajectory of moving from pre-diabetes into diabetes, and we honestly can't sustain this kind of growth.
The potential savings from preventing cases of type 2 diabetes could be staggering, but the YMCA's Matt Longjohn says only 10% of people with pre-diabetes know they're at risk.
What percentage of those people are actually motivated to make behavior change while they're happily living their lives?
Longjohn says, sure, on paper, the market for these services is enormous. He just wonders how many of us are really ready to make the necessary changes. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
India is one of just a few countries that allows commercial surrogacy, paying a woman to carry and give birth to your child. Now, the Indian government plans to stop foreign couples from using surrogate services there. It's estimated that 2,000 Indian women every year carry someone else's child in return for money. Anand, a town in the western state of Gujarat, is informally called the surrogacy capital of India. The BBC's Yogita Limai went there to find out what this ban will mean.
A baby girl's just been born at Akanksha Hospital. Wrapped tightly in a blue blanket, only her face is visible as she lets out another cry. The infant's taken to meet the woman who gave birth to her, a surrogate mother who's recovering after the delivery. She asks about the child's health, pats her, and then it's time for the baby to go. Her parents are waiting. In a room just below, the sound of the heartbeat of a baby yet to be born comes from a sonography machine. Farzana Chauhan, a 32-year-old woman, is undergoing a scan. She's a surrogate too, and is carrying a child for an Irish couple. Farzana is a single mother, and with the $10,000 she'll be paid, she wants to build a home and send her daughter to school.
I'm uneducated and work on a farm. I barely earn enough to feed us. As a laborer, I can never think of making the money that I get from surrogacy. It will change my life. I want to tell the government that it's good to have foreign clients because they pay us well.
When women like Farzana agree to become surrogates here in Anand, they're asked to stay in what are called surrogate homes for the duration of the pregnancy. I'm in one of them right now, and what I can see in front of me is a dormitory kind of setup. There are about 10 beds in one big room. Women are lying on them in different stages of pregnancy. Most of them are wearing nightgowns. There's a television set playing in the corner. This is where they're given their meals, and they also have regular medical checkups. And the reason why they have to stay here until the delivery is to make sure that both the baby as well as the mother are looked after and are safe, something that may not necessarily happen if they go back to their own homes. Many women here are carrying babies for foreign couples, which the Indian government now wants to stop. This country was becoming a popular destination for surrogacy. It's easy to find women here willing to bear someone else's child. There's good medical technology too, and crucially, it's cheap. Surrogacy in the US would cost at least three times as much, simply not an affordable option for many couples.
That's the sad thing, that people are so desperate that they're willing to rent out their bodies, you know, for something like this. I mean, given a choice, and if they could make a decent livelihood, I'm sure they wouldn't want, this meat to be the option by which they earn money.
Dr. Soumya Swaminathan, who's been helping write the new law banning foreigners from using surrogate services, says India is simply following what's practiced in many other countries, including the UK, Ireland, Belgium and Australia.
When it's not allowed in their own countries, there's really no reason why we should be allowing it here. Moreover, the class of women who's involved in this is mostly the poor and the illiterate and the vulnerable. So the government has a duty to protect them.
At the surrogate home, women watch their children play in a small yard. They believe that carrying someone else's baby has helped them give a better life to their own sons and daughters. But many other Indian women won't have that chance anymore. and foreign couples dreaming of homes full of carefree laughter and frantic games will have to look elsewhere.
That was the BBC's Yogita Lamai reporting from India. Coming up,
you haven't started Monday. By the time Sunday night football kicks off, you're already behind.
Everybody's working on the weekends, but first, let's do the numbers. In an abbreviated trading session, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 14.9 points to close nearly unchanged at 17,798. The NASDAQ rose 11.38 points, or 0.2%, to finish at 5,127. The S&P 500 added 1.24 points to end the day at 2,090. It's only one day into the official holiday shopping season, and investors are already nervous about the retail sector. Gap was down almost 2.5%, Macy's declined almost 1%, and Best Buy was off 1.5%. The Dow Jones U.S. General Retailers Index fell 1.5%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.2%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. President Obama signed several bills into law this week before heading off to Europe for the Paris climate talks, including a law that updates the way the U.S. government thinks about the commercial space industry and the potential for new business opportunities out there on the final frontier. Think this. That is more formally called the Space Act of 2015. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams joins me from Washington to talk about it. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi, Molly.
So now I feel like the thing that's maybe getting the most attention or is the most interesting aspect of this new law is what it says about mining on asteroids. What's in there?
Well, it's pretty cool, right? Of course it's interesting. It's mining on asteroids. And basically what this new law says is that American companies that go into space, if they make it and if they grab some rocks or drill some minerals out from asteroids or the moon, that they own those resources. Now, the reason this had to be said is because we have international treaties that say no countries, including the U.S., can claim land in space and actually own it. So this law kind of gets around that by saying, okay, we're not claiming the land, but we're saying our companies can take what they mine out of it. And the United States is basically trying to lead in this area, hoping that the policies that we are setting out in this will at least start the discussion or set the precedent for the rest of the international community. Whether or not the other countries that are party to this treaty will agree with that, we'll see.
And why is asteroid mining so appealing for companies? Why are we trying to lead this discussion now?
money, money, money. A lot of these asteroids are loaded up with really valuable minerals. And I mean, some of them are things like iron ore and copper, but also gold and platinum. Things that when you have an asteroid full of platinum, we're talking billions of dollars in resources, not millions. And also a lot of companies are saying, look, most of the expense of getting out into space and the difficulty is stocking up on enough fuel to get you where you want to go. But if we could refuel in space, that would save a lot of money and resources. And so they want to also mine these resources for the materials that you need to create more fuel.
So the asteroid is a win-win and a win, is what you're saying, in terms of business opportunities.
If they can actually mine them, yeah.
And that would be the key. So what else is in this new law? It is the Space Act of 2015. So it's not only about asteroid mining. What else is in there?
It does a lot of other things. It reauthorizes U.S. support for the International Space Station until 2014. It sets up new processes to streamline getting permission for commercial launches. It also allows for an extension of what they're calling the learning period for the commercial spaceflight industry. Basically, this idea that companies are still sorting out exactly how to operate in this field, and the government wants to give them space away from formal regulation to figure out how to do that. I spoke to Aaron Osterly, who's the policy director for the Space Frontier Foundation, and I actually caught him while he was in the car traveling with his family for the holidays.
When the industry started operating and developing new launch vehicles, and specifically reusable launch vehicles, they're going to be a very different vehicle than we've ever flown before. But if we want to have a broader industry, if we want to have the big visions of like space settlement, you're going to have flights that are on par with modern day aviation.
You know, and as we just saw with the Blue Origins company, these companies are figuring out how to bring back the rockets that we send into space. And this is moving very quickly, and the U.S. government is trying to keep up with it.
That's Kimberly Adams from Washington. Thanks so much, Kimberly.
You're welcome, Molly.
Different kind of flight now. The Los Angeles International Airport is not known for its cutting-edge facilities or above-average retail and restaurant spaces. But here's some good news. LAX just approved a plan to redevelop a cargo hangar into a new terminal. Maybe it's not that good a news. The new terminal is not for regular people. It's for celebrities, athletes, and other wealthy folks who are willing to pay a high price for high-end lounges and their own security lines. Marketplace's Noelle King reports.
We thought travelers might find this unfair, so we went out to LAX. Most agreed with Lori Atencio, visiting from Albuquerque.
I think if they're paying for it and funding it, yeah, why not?
But is it fair?
Fairness? I'm not really concerned about fairness. Life's not fair.
Celebrity photographers aren't as blasé. Giles Harrison says his colleagues are talking about it all over Facebook.
Basically, they would say, you know, they can kiss their opportunities for getting pictures at the airport pretty much goodbye. I don't necessarily wholeheartedly agree with that, but it will certainly make getting photos at LAX of celebrities who don't want their photo taking a lot more difficult.
Mary Grady oversees PR for Los Angeles World Airports. That's the agency that operates LAX. She says the terminal is modeled after one in London that caters to the royal family. LA, of course, has its own kind of royalty.
We will have Korean pop groups come through, and the fans find out. And the next thing you know, you have 300 fans who've shown up to the airport.
Grady says LAX has a unique congestion problem with the constant stream of celebrities, and she hopes the new terminal will help. It's being built and paid for by a private security firm called Gavin DeBecker and Associates, and technically,
anybody can use the terminal. The fees will be set by Gavin DeBecker and Associates. So it is not just for celebrities. It's really for anybody who would be willing to pay the price that they set.
Reportedly between $1,500 and $1,800 per flight. Grady says that will add up to about $3.7 million in revenue each year. She says that money will go toward improving other less elite parts of LAX. I'm Noelle King for Marketplace.
Here's a question we can debate forever. Has technology freed us from the office or tethered us to it? Either way, one thing does seem clear. Thanks to all that connectedness, Sunday nights are not what they used to be. Commentator Beth Titel explains.
Until now, Sunday had held its own in our shifting world. Never mind that Thursday has been declared the new Friday, and Cyber Monday is the new Black Friday, and Christmas starts in October, and TV shows premiere in summer, and schools begin in August. Sunday night was Sunday night. Only the doctors and the drug dealers were on call. But now we're all on duty all the time, and that includes Sunday night, which has turned into the new Monday morning. We can blame two culprits: our beloved digital devices, which have erased the boundaries between cubicle and living room, and globalization. Sunday night in New York is literally Monday morning in Asia. Better respond to those client emails now. For many people, the feeling is that if you haven't started Monday by the time Sunday night football kicks off, when your alarm clock rings, you're already behind. And that's not just paranoia speaking. Almost one-third of all workers polled by Gallup said their employers generally expect them to check email and stay in touch remotely outside of normal business hours. Normal business hours. These days, what are those anyway? In 2015, I fear we all sound like Maggie Smith in Downton Abbey, who asked famously in an episode set in 1912.
What is a weekend?
Beth Titel is a reporter with the Boston Globe. Hey, so enjoy your weekend, everybody. This final note before we go, everything old is new again. The Mattel Viewmaster. Remember this toy from your childhood? You'd put those round little picture wheels in it and click through to see 3D images of animals or the pyramids in Egypt. All sorts of cool places and things. It debuted, actually, in 1939 at the World's Fair. And you could argue it was kind of a very early virtual reality viewer. Which is why it makes so much sense that the Viewmaster is coming back this year as an actual virtual reality viewer. Just for kids. Apparently, the Viewmaster has never really gone away in the last 77 years, but Adweek reports that Mattel recently consulted with Google and figured out how to use Google's VR platform to recreate a next-generation Viewmaster. It goes on sale December 1st with virtual reality content from National Geographic and NASA, and yes, it all comes on little disc reels, just like the original. And that's our show for this Friday. Not a lot of activity on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was basically flat. The NASDAQ was up 0.2%, and the S&P 500 added just one tiny point. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. And I am Molly Wood. Kai Ryssdal will be back on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.